Today on the Rising Coaches Podcast.
Right. The best coaches, whether it's John Gallagher at Hartford, Mike Krzyzewski at Duke, or Bill Belichick coaching the New England Patriots, all have great communication skills.
Thanks for listening to the Rising Coaches Podcast. This is Adam Gordon, and today we are joined by best-selling author and reporter John Feinstein. John has written the book, The Backroads to March, The Unsung, Unheralded, and Unknown Heroes of a College Basketball Season, and he joins us today to talk about what went into writing the book, the research, the stories. Really an interesting book. He does a great job of covering every side of college basketball, not just the blue bloods, not just the big names, but going into great detail about low major programs, Division III programs, as well as some of the more household names that you hear. Of course, John also wrote the book Season on the Brink, which highlighted a season with Bob Knight, and we talk about Coach Knight and his experience with him, as well as college basketball in general. We hope you enjoy the podcast. We have a special book giveaway, compliments of John Feinstein. We're giving away 5 copies of his new book to the first 5 people to send an email to adam@risingcoaches.com with the subject line reading March. So email adam@risingcoaches.com with the subject March for a chance to win a copy of John Feinstein's new book. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Please write us a review on iTunes. Please subscribe. Please spread the word. And please follow along with what we are doing at risingcoaches.com. Before we get into today's podcast, I want to talk to you about the Rising Coaches membership, and specifically about the Two Coaches a Month program. The Two Coaches a Month program is for our members. We pair them up with another coach on the 1st and 15th of each month and give them a topic of discussion. And the expectation is that those two coaches get on the phone within a week and spend at least 10 minutes on the phone with each other. What ends up happening is most of those conversations last 30, 45 minutes, an hour, and already great friendships and relationships have been formed due to two coaches a month. In light of the coronavirus and what's going on in the world now, the quarantines, and of course the Final Four and coaching convention being canceled, it makes networking and meeting new coaches so much more difficult. So in response to that, we are ramping up the two coaches a month program. We're doing it once a week at this point. During this time, every Friday, we're pairing up coaches, a great way to meet new people despite what's going on in the world today. So we hope you consider joining. Visit risingcoaches.com/membership. You can sign up today for just $120 a year.
Hello.
John, thanks for joining us this morning. How are you?
I'm good, Adam. How are you?
I'm doing great. We appreciate you being on the podcast. I've got a copy of your new book right here, The Backroads to March, The Unsung, Unheralded, and Unknown Heroes of College Basketball Season. John, maybe you can start off by telling us a little bit about, you know, where the idea for the book came from and what made you want to dive into this one.
Well, Adam, it probably goes back to my early days as covering college basketball at the Washington Post. My first Final Four, was in 1978 in St. Louis, when the first game on Saturday started at 2:30 in the afternoon. There were a total of 6 TV timeouts, 90 seconds each in the game. The games took an hour and 40 minutes, maybe. We were in a real basketball arena. And you had time after the games to talk to players, talk to coaches, and to write, because they weren't played in the middle of the night the way they are now. And when I was cutting my teeth as a college basketball reporter at the Washington Post, there was an intimacy to what I was able to do as a reporter. You got to know people. There were no interview rooms, and you could walk into practice pretty much anytime, anywhere. Unlike now, where you need a court order to get into a practice at a lot of places. And I wanted to try to get back to that kind of feeling about the games and about the people that I was going to write about. And I knew I could do that by going kind of down a level from the ACC, Big Ten, Big 12, SEC, Pac-12 axis, throwing the Big East, to writing about players, coaches, teams who aren't on ESPN every night, who don't have Dick Vitale screaming about diaper dandies, and who don't have freshmen on their team who are being speculated on as lottery picks before they play a college game. And it was a book that had been kind of in the back of my mind that I wanted to do for a while for all those reasons. And it turned out to be even more fun than I thought it could be, because I met so many kids and coaches who had great stories to tell. I've always been a believer, dating to my days, again, 100 years ago, as the night police reporter at the Post when I worked for Bob Woodward, that you don't have to be rich and famous to have a great story to tell. And I think that's what this book is really about. I'll give you one example. Griff Aldridge, who played Division III ball at Hampton, Sydney, went to Virginia Law School, got out of law school, wanted to be a coach, but he had $100,000 in tuition loans to pay back. So he got hired at a Houston law firm, worked his way up and became a partner, and was making about $800,000 a year. And at the age of 42 said, you know what, I'm making a lot of money, but I'm not having that much fun. I miss basketball. And he called his old teammate, Ryan Odom, when Ryan got the job at UMBC, and said, I want to coach. And Ryan offered him a job as director of basketball operations for $32,000 a year, and he took it. He moved his wife, his three kids, from Houston to Baltimore. And as you well know, they had their run in their second year when they won the America East title, upsetting a very good Vermont team, and then, of course, stunned Virginia in the first round of the tournament, becoming the first number 16 seed to win a game. The president of Longwood was looking for a coach, and he happened to have gone to UVA Law School right after Griff, so he was aware of Griff and his career arc, called him, interviewed him, hired him. And Griff became the coach at Longwood a year ago, and I went down to spend a day with him and his team. And during the afternoon, we were talking about the game that night against High Point, who's now coached by Tubby Smith. And Griff said, this is one of the great coaching matchups of all time. Tubby with 606 wins in a national championship and me with 12 wins. My players better be a lot better than his players tonight. Well, they were good enough to win. But during the game, and this kind of sums up the experience of last winter for me, my wife sent me a text. And my wife was an English lit major at Vassar, so her knowledge of sports is not very extensive. She sent me a text and said, I forget where you are. When will you be home tonight? So I texted back and I said, I'm in Farmville, Virginia. I'll be home about midnight. And her return text said, you're having an affair. There's no such place as Farmville, Virginia. So the chapter on that day is titled, Yes, Christine, There Is a Farmville.
That's funny. Maybe we can talk a little bit about that specific example, because Longwood, you know, most of our listeners are coaches, and right, what you've described, telling the story of programs that don't have, you know, multiple lottery picks. That's real life. That's just another day in the office for most of us.
Exactly.
You know, Longwood is not a great job, but he has done an unbelievable job there, and has got them competitive and towards the top half of that league. I think right now they're sitting at 9-9, which is great, you know, in third, tied for third or fourth place in the Big South. What did you take away from your time at Longwood and with Griff in regards to, you know, his leadership style? How is he able to turn something like that around so quickly?
Yeah, well, you're right, because, you know, they won 7 games the year before he got there. They won 15 in his first year, helped by a fairly weak non-conference schedule. And then this year they played a much tougher non-conference schedule. And as you said, finished 9-9 in the league, really came on strong late in February to finish in fourth and get the fourth seed in the Big South tournament. And then unfortunately met a Hampton team that's very capable of playing great and got beaten pretty badly on Thursday night in the first round, of that tournament. But I think Griff brought almost a unique background in that while he was a lawyer, he coached AAU ball on the side, and not one of those AAU teams that travels around the country, but one that it was called His Hoops, capital H, because Griff is deeply religious, and he wanted to combine schoolwork with basketball with faith. And one of the kids that came to his program was a kid named Shabuti Phillips, who walked in to the gym and basically said, "Why should I play for you? I mean, you know, you're a lawyer. What can you teach me about basketball?" And Griff said, "Let's play a little one-on-one." And Griff was a decent D3 player, and he kicked Shabuti Phillips' butt. And as he points out, Shabuti was 14, so he did have that advantage. But long story short, Shabuti played for him. Griff eventually decided to get him to a bigger AAU program so he'd get some exposure among college coaches. And he went to a junior college and then transferred to Longwood and played the last 2 years for Griff at Longwood. So developing relationships along the way can certainly pay off for any coach. And I think Griff's obviously very bright. You don't graduate from Virginia Law School without being bright. And he uses that intellect, combines that intellect, I think, with a lot of emotion. I mean, he gets after his, when I was there, he got after his players when he didn't think they were performing the way he expected them to. He also did something that fascinated me and tells you a lot about his approach. His best player, whose name I'm blocking on right now, it's in the book, but wasn't going to class. And Griff, you know, was all over him. He was a fifth-year senior. You got to go to class. You got to graduate. You know, please, I'm begging you. And he suspended him to try to get the message through, and he continued not to go to class. And early February, you know, with the team at the most important juncture of the season, he threw his leading scorer off the team because he thought it was the best thing for the kid. That the kid really needed to understand that he's not going to be a first-round NBA pick, and he needs to graduate. And the kid did graduate. The team missed him, but I think he made a very important point to the kid and also to the rest of his players that I'm not here just to use you to win basketball games. And I think the best coaches all do that. And in that sense, Adam, it doesn't matter the level. When Christian Laettner came up one credit short of graduating in 1992. His number had been retired. They'd won back-to-back national championships. And Mike Krzyzewski called him. Laettner had been selected for the Dream Team that year, called him and said, "Christian, if you don't get your degree the first semester of summer school, I'm taking your number down." And obviously Laettner got the message and got his degree because there was no reason for him not to. But sometimes you got to do that stuff.
Yeah, that's great. And that, one of the things I love about your writing is you know, you really do seem to spend time with these programs and these coaches or athletes that you've followed through the years, and really give you a feel of what it's actually like on a day-to-day basis. And obviously,
yeah, well,
oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
You know, I was going to say, I'm lucky that way because, as you know, I wrote my first book in 1986 about a coach named Bob Knight. And, even though he didn't love the book, I think most coaches who read it felt like it gave them a sense of who Bob was and that there was a method to his madness. And since then, I've been pretty fortunate getting access. Access, to for me, is critical. When I did my ACC book in 1997, the only coach who didn't let me in the locker room during games was Dean Smith, and I knew Dean wouldn't. I actually went to him last among the then nine coaches. It's before the ACC was a 36-team league. And told him what I was doing, and Dean said, "What do you want?" And I said, "Well, I want to come to practice, no problem, and I want to be in the locker room before and during and after games." And Dean said, "You know I'm not going to let you do that. And we don't even let our managers in the locker room at halftime." and I said, "I am." He said, "This is our tradition, John. This is what we do." And I said, knowing what a civil rights activist Dean was, I said, "Dean, slavery was a tradition once too." And he looked at me and he said, "You're not really trying to compare getting in my locker room to slavery, are you?" And I said, "Well, it was worth a shot."
It was worth
but
a shot.
For the most part, like when I did this book, every coach was welcoming in terms of time, in terms of access. In fact, when I called Jimmy Allen, the Army coach, because they were going to go play at Duke, and I wanted to write about what it was like for kids at that level to play in Cameron Indoor Stadium because it's a lifetime thrill for most of them. And I said, you know, I'd like to come spend a day with you. And Jimmy said, I've watched Duke on tape a couple times. As far as I'm concerned, you can give the pregame talk. Because he knew how that was the Zion Williamson group, obviously, last year. And it was funny because I came out of the Army locker room, and as you probably know, in Cameron, the visitors have to cross the home team bench to get to their bench. And Krzyzewski always stands there and shakes hands with all the coaches. And I was walking out with the coaches, and Mike looked at me and said, what the blank are you doing here? And I said, well, I gave the pregame talk. And he kind of gave me a look. And at halftime, Army was only down six. So as the teams crossed, I said to Krzyzewski, I said, hey, I guess I did a pretty good job, huh? And he didn't even crack a smile because he was so mad.
That's funny. I'm glad you brought up Season on the Brink and you know, obviously the book that puts you on the map, and you got to spend a lot of time with Coach Knight. Over the years,
more
than you wanted to. I'm sure the feeling was mutual.
you know, that's a good line, but one of the reasons I spent as much time with Bob that season, especially at night, was because he was going through his divorce. And before I got there, Bob can't be alone. And so every night, at least one of the assistants had to go to dinner with him. When I showed up, because it was beneficial to me, obviously, I went to dinner with him every night. So the coaches loved me because they got to go home and spend time with their families. I had no life. I went to dinner with Bob every night, and it helped the book, and it kept Bob busy.
That's funny. Okay, well, before I ask the question I was going to, since we were talking about him, you know, talk about him returning to Indiana this year. Was that emotional for you watching that?
I'm not going to go so far as to say it was emotional. I was happy to see it. I wrote a column in the Washington Post about it and about the fact that it should have happened years ago. I mean, Bob spent 10 years trying to get the last word in on Miles Brand, the president who fired him, after Miles Brand had died. And that's classic Bob. He always has to have the last word in any debate, argument, discussion. If he doesn't get the last word, it infuriates him. And that's been throughout his life when he's acted out. But he's not doing well in terms of his health, as you probably know. And I know a number of friends, he moved back to Bloomington for better medical care, and a number of his friends there said, we're having a 40th anniversary for your 1980 Big Ten championship team. This is the time to come back. You'll see a lot of your ex-players. You know how you'll be responded to in this inside Assembly Hall. And he finally agreed to do it, and I'm glad he did. And I'm glad he got the response that he got. Interestingly, when I wrote the column, I basically said what I've said dating to 1986 about Bob. There's a lot to criticize. He's a bully. He's a pathological liar, which is why I think he honestly believed that he and I had some kind of agreement to leave his profanity out of the book, which we didn't. In fact, I specifically told him that his favorite word had to be in the book or it wouldn't have any credibility. And basketball is not his favorite word, by the way. But then I also pointed out the positives, how many lives he touched, how most of his players swore that he'd made them better players and better people. And the reaction to the column was almost visceral, based on the comments I read, saying, how can you possibly defend this man? He's a terrible human being. Now, none of these people ever met Bob Knight. And don't know that there are two sides to him. But I was actually surprised at how visceral the reaction was to the column because it didn't trash Knight.
Interesting. Well, it was powerful to watch, and I think we all shared the same sentiment that we're glad it happened. So you've had this.
It's good that it happened, and you know Bob's going to be 80 in October, and he's not well, and I think he understood this was the time to do it.
No, that's great. Now, you've had this inside access, inside college hoops, in other sports as well, but specifically in college hoops for what, almost 30 years now. And obviously the game's changed, and you touched on it in terms of the media coverage and, you know, the lack of intimacy that maybe you no longer have at Final
Right.
Fours or games. How has it changed in the locker room, in the practice gym? What changes have you seen there from a leadership standpoint?
I don't think that it's changed all that much, to be honest, Adam. I think coaching is still coaching. I think when coaches are with their teams, they you know, I've always said that people always talk about, people who think they know the game will say, well, he's not a good X and O coach. They're all good X and O coaches. Anybody who gets to be a Division I head coach or assistant coach knows the X's and O's of the game. It's like saying, do I know the alphabet? And coaching is about leadership. It's about communication. It's about understanding that you don't treat every player the same because every player is not the same. You know, again, going back to Season on the Brink, Knight would brutalize Steve Alford because he knew Alford could take it. And he was gentler most of the time with Daryl Thomas because he knew Daryl Thomas couldn't take it. And then I use them as examples because they were at opposite ends of the emotional pole. And I think the best coaches understand that. Now, where there has been a sea change, which is not really part of this book, although I certainly reference it, is at those top programs that recruit the one-and-dones every year, Duke, Kentucky, Kansas, whomever, because Mike Krzyzewski was always about building, not only building relationships, but about making sure that Grant Hill was a different player as a senior than he was as a freshman, about making sure that a guy like J.J. Redick, who couldn't guard you or me when he got to Duke, became a reasonably good defender by the time he graduated 4 years later. He can't do that anymore. John Calipari can't do that because they know that those freshmen are never going to be sophomores. And that's why you saw, 3 years ago, I think, Duke play zone for an entire season. Duke playing zone? And I remember I said to Krzyzewski after that season, I got to tell you, it was just weird to see you guys coming out in the zone every night. And he said, it would have been weirder to see us go 16-16. And he understood there was a time when he would have said, go back to their last national championship. Jahlil Okafor was on that team and a key guy on that team and a great low post player in an era where there are no low post players. But I said to Krzyzewski at one point, Jahlil Okafor can't guard me. And he said, no, he can guard. He just chooses not to. Now, do you think 10 years ago he would have accepted that from a freshman, no matter how talented? Or he would have said, you're not going to play big minutes until you work at trying to play defense. But they don't have that luxury anymore. He knows he's never going to get Jahlil Okafor to play defense because he's never going to be a sophomore. And I think in that sense, coaching at the highest level in college ball has changed. I think at the mid-major level or even the low mid-major level, it's still pretty much the same. You're trying to take freshmen and do two things. One change, of course, is how many players transfer. Tom Izzo said to me earlier this year that he feels like if he has a freshman who doesn't play 20 minutes in his first game, he's going to transfer the next day. It's an exaggeration, but we know how many players do transfer nowadays. So you have to be aware of that, but at the same time, you're trying to get the guy who's a 4 on a scale of 1 to 10 as a freshman to be a 7 or an 8 by the time he graduates.
Do you think that transfer trend that you see in college basketball has almost trickled that, even though mid-majors aren't coaching one-and-dones that are going to the NBA, in a lot of ways, they are taking a lot of grad transfers and kids that they may only have for one season.
Yeah,
it seems like the best ones are figuring that out and adapting, similar to the high major coaches you just referenced.
Yeah, it's almost become, I mean, there are separate lists for potential grad transfers that coaches reference. And a lot of them go in and say, okay, I've got, I'll give you an example, Hartford this year. John Gallagher lost all 5 of his starters last season off of what was a good team that lost an incredible double overtime game in the semifinals of the America East tournament to UMBC. And he's basically on square one. And he had some kids coming in who he liked, but he knew he needed some experience on the team. So he went out and recruited two grad transfers who had already been to two schools. And they came in, one of them's Purvis Ellison's son, and they came in and gave Hartford a foundation that he could build the young players around, and Hartford again finished 3rd in the America East, even having lost every one of their starters. They actually lost their first 6 players. Usually at that level, you have that kind of graduation, then it takes you 2 years to get back to being competitive. But because of transfers and grad transfers specifically, a team can, a mid-major team can rebuild quickly now.
John, you've covered not just basketball, but you know some of the greats in many sports. What is some of the best coaches and leaders have in common?
Well, it's a good question because they do have similar traits. The best coaches, whether it's John Gallagher at Hartford, Mike Krzyzewski at Duke, or Bill Belichick coaching the New England Patriots, all have great communication skills. Now, you might say Belichick, but he may not communicate with the media, but he sure as heck communicates with his players. And they respect what he's telling them. They believe in what he's telling them. And sometimes it takes a while. You have to kind of establish that you know what you're doing. Belichick was given a second chance at New England after failing in Cleveland. And some coaches, Dean Smith and Mike Krzyzewski, one thing they have in common is several years ago when I wrote a book on the two of them and Jim Valvano, they both said, and today, Dean had told me it earlier because he was sick when I did the book, but Mike reiterated it, that if they were coaching when I was writing the book, which was 2015, neither one of them would have lasted 4 years because Krzyzewski had a losing record and Dean was barely over 500 in their first 3 years. So sometimes you got to give a coach, a leader, time to establish who he is and what he's doing and obviously to recruit. But a different kind of example is Davey Martinez, the manager of the Washington Nationals, who everybody, even the local media here that you know, constantly sucks up to all teams Washington, wanted to run him out of town last May. You know, you pick the wrong guy, fire him, get a new manager. Well, we all know what happened with the Nationals last year. But I think it's communicating. It's what I said before about understanding that every player is different. You know, Bob Knight, as much of a disciplinarian as he was, and Mike Krzyzewski, who obviously played and coached under Bob Knight, have no rules. They don't have any rules. Their one rule is don't be an idiot. You know, don't drink and drive. Don't get into a bar fight. Don't stay out till 3 a.m. You know, and these days, you would add, don't be caught on a cell phone doing something dumb. But there are no rules. And Knight told me the reason he had no rules was because if a good kid makes a mistake, I can call him in and say, okay, you made a mistake. Here's why. Don't do it again. But if a bad kid makes a mistake, a kid who's already been trouble, then you throw him off the team or you suspend him, whatever it might be. And the only rule that he had that was set in stone was you damn well better go to class. Because if you didn't go to class, you didn't practice. If you didn't practice, you didn't play. But the best coaches, I think, understand that rules are kind of a cop-out, that they make your job easier because you broke a rule, this is what happens. But if you have to make individual decisions every time something happens, and it's going to happen, doesn't matter where you're coaching, then it might be harder, but it's also ultimately better for your team.
Yeah, John, and I can't stress it enough how much I enjoy in this book that you do cover so many different coaches and programs and not just the blue blood, so to speak. And one of the coaches you spend some time with in the book is Coach Calhoun. Mm-hmm. What was that experience like? I mean, crazy to see, you know, the legendary UConn coach now at the Division III level, but, you know, what's he like these days?
Exactly the same as he was 20 years ago. Just as intense, just as fiery, just as crazy. When I went to see the University of St. Joseph's play, which, by the way, is 26-2 this year in Jim's second year there, and it's not St. Joseph's University. It's the University of St. Joseph's, which is in West Hartford, Connecticut. Jim should have been thrown out of the game I was at 3 or 4 times. He'd already been thrown out of one game. But the three referees, I think, combined age was less than Jim's 76, and they just didn't want to throw him out because he's Jim Calhoun. So they kept running over to the bench saying, coach, okay, we understand. Calm down. Please get off the court. But he was after it at least at the same level as when he coached in Final Fours. And what he told me was, if I'm going to do this, I owe it to the players to give them everything I gave to my players at UConn. And that's what coaches do. Coaches coach. Cliff Ellis was another coach I spent time with. And he'd been, of course, at Clemson and Auburn. And when he got the chance to go to Coastal Carolina, one of the people he called was Krzyzewski, and he said, "What do you think about going down to this level from where I've been?" Tubby Smith, same type of thing. And they both were told, Tubby was told this by Cliff, ironically, because they're good friends, and Cliff was told this by Krzyzewski, coaching's coaching. You get in the gym, you're trying to get players to get better, you're teaching them, you're trying to make sure they do the right things. Now, you're not going to be on charter airplanes anymore. That's what Tubby told me. He told me the biggest difference being at High Point versus Kentucky and Georgia and Memphis and Minnesota and Texas Tech was that he's riding chartered buses now instead of chartered airplanes. But coaching's still coaching. And that's why Jim is coaching. That's why Cliff is coaching. That's why Tubby is coaching.
Yeah, that's great. And again, the book is has so many great stories and nuggets about so many different programs, and surely will be enjoyable to any basketball fan, let alone coach. We're going to give out. We appreciate you doing this, but your team sent over some copies of the book, so we're going to do a raffle and give those out to some of our listeners. And we appreciate you being on the show today.
Thanks for having me, Adam. Good to talk to you.
We hope you enjoyed today's podcast. Just a quick reminder to write us a review on iTunes and subscribe to the podcast. Please tell your friends, and please follow along with everything that we're doing at risingcoaches.com.